from deep inside your radio.
Every edition of Le Show is special, but this one is particularly special because I am sitting in a studio with, I'm going to embarrass him. He's one of my idols. He's one of the people who inspired me to get on this crooked path. And he's the dean of American satirists. I hope that's not putting you on a pedestal of inactivity when you're still out there doing the work on a constant basis. Mort Saul, thank you for coming in.
Oh, Harry, it's good to see you again. Too long. Well, you know, when I was in Australia, they called me the father of stand-up comedians. And I wanted a saliva test.
You got started, as to my ken, in San Francisco, or you came to national awareness in San Francisco, yeah, doing a series of gigs at the Hungry Eye. Yes.
Yes, and totally by accident, and I left here because there wasn't anything happening here. I tried here in 51.
Really?
I left L.A. I followed a girl to Berkeley. And she said to me, after a period of long unemployment, she said, go to the Hungry Eye, because the crowd that goes there, if they like you, our troubles are over. And if they don't like you, they'll laugh anyway because they'll think it's whimsical humor.
Whimsical.
She was pretty gifted.
Yeah.
And Susan. So, and then Enrico didn't want to fire me. You know Enrico.
Enrico Banducci.
Yes, he's still up there.
Really?
He was very good to everybody, and he was kind of the Saul Hurock of North Beach.
Were you there every night?
Yeah, that's how I learned to do it. What happened was the man that wrote That's Amore, Jack Brooks,
yeah,
married Dorothy Baker, who was an actor, and she left for the honeymoon. And he gave me the week, and then he told the manager to fire me, and the manager said, you don't ever get your hands dirty, you fire him. So I just kept staying there in my desperation, trying to get it together, to trust my own instincts instead of doing imitations of movie stars and wearing a tie. And I stayed there, and, you know, we did shows for two people.
Mm.
The audience was pretty barbaric.
Really?
Yeah, I was terrible, and they were...
They didn't think you were whimsical.
Not hardly.
Now, you talk about wearing a tie. The standard comedian garb in those days was suit and tie or tuxedo. You came out in a sweater with a rolled-up newspaper and talked about what was going on in the news that day. Was that the way the act started, or did it
the
evolve?
Act started... I had a suit that Stan Kenton gave me. You know me with the jazz.
Mm-hmm.
A suit from the leftover from the band, and I came out, and because I thought of Will Rogers, I had the paper, and Enrico told me to take the tie off, then the coat off, and then I came up with this idea of the perpetual graduate student with the sweater and the loafers and the white shirt, and I tried you know, everything I knew, but the asides were getting the laughs when I dropped the prepared material.
Mm.
So a lot of it is accidental. You know, Castro says that he looks back and he realizes the revolution had started 6 months before he realized it. He was up in the hills. And so, you know, I finally went to what I what I cared about, and the first political joke was every time the Russians throw an American in jail, we throw an American in jail on American activities. Mm-hmm. And the Eisenhower jacket made into a McCarthy jacket with a flap from the lapel that would go over the mouth. And people were livid.
Mm.
And because of my obtuse nature, I thought if they were livid, you were good. I was always that way, though. When I lost the amateur shows, I was angry. You know, never change, never change. So you have to listen to the voice within, unless it's your father's. I don't know.
How long were you doing this in San Francisco before you became a national figure, started doing recordings
of your
act?
Well, we started there in Christmas of 53. And in 58, I came down here and I met Lawford's manager. And then Joe Kennedy called me and asked me to write for the president, who was then the senator. And I did. And then I hit the Time cover in 60.
Mm.
And then the old man turned on me. He got mad because I kidded his son. The old man, well, you know about the old man. The tough guy.
Yeah.
And
interesting background.
Yeah, and all that time, you know, I thought I was in love with all the starlets, you know, and I wanted to escape what I came from. So then I met a lot of the candidates, and I had it to myself because the Democrats had nobody. In fact, Stevenson had said to me, the Democrats are the most oppressed majority in history. And then I began to work for a lot of people, you know, and a lot of it became a mystery to people when I knew Reagan and I knew Haig. But the party got taken over by the Democratic Leadership Conference. And so that's when it all began to run down here. So I was imported back here.
Mm.
And New York, which I had failed in, imported me back. So there's some kind of a lesson then.
Well, people ask me all the time, you know, kids ask me about show business and stuff, and I have nothing to, no useful information to impart, but I always feel like I have to say something. So I say, well, talent is good, luck is better, but nothing beats persistence, you know? And you're a standing example of it. There's a quote of yours that I've mangled repeatedly over the years, and I want to check that you've said it first and what the authentic version of it is, but it has something to do with whether it's accurate or not. Assume the audience is intelligence. Is it?
Yeah.
Tell me what the real version of that is, and then.
Well, the real version was that I, you know, because you know how grandiose I am. I thought I was the attorney for the damned. I thought I was Clarence Darrow, because you couldn't discriminate against Jews. You couldn't discriminate against blacks or Indians or women. But if you discriminated against everybody, like a network executive, and said people are stupid, so I was going to prove that they're not. And, of course, they're not. And as Freud says, if you express what's on their unconscious, you'll reach them. Men know there's a war with women, an uneasy truce, maybe. And they knew who Nixon was, and they knew who McCarthy was, and they knew there's certain things they wouldn't accept, Harry, in all honesty. For instance, they would never accept Nixon as innocent, even if he had virtue. And they wouldn't accept Reagan as guilty,
mm-hmm.
even if he was. They stopped you. When it came to the terrible thing, the Warren Commission, they wanted you to present them as a bunch of bumbling bureaucrats rather than a conspiratorial, in other words, a consensus rather than a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they come from. And then later on, I learned a lot of other things. I learned that you can say there's something wrong and everybody would cheer you, but if they thought you were also saying it's their fault, they wouldn't
cheer
you.
They'd turn on you.
And Vietnam taught me that it wasn't altruism that would do it. I found the liberals to be very righteous, but it was when mothers didn't want their sons to go.
Mm. Mm. You mentioned a couple of times President Kennedy and the Warren Commission.
Yeah.
So off the air, you said somebody had said to you that assassination not only killed President Kennedy, but it killed your career.
Killed my career.
Let's talk about that.
All right, if you want to.
If you don't want to, we don't have to.
I don't ever try to proselytize to people anymore. You know, we presented it, and they made up their minds, and if they can...
But what effect did it have on you? I mean, I want to talk about its effect on you.
Well, what its effect it had was that people didn't want to hear about it because if they acknowledged murder, it was incumbent upon them to do something about it. So they tried to attach a thing that I love them. Joan Rivers, of all people, saying I loved him and I couldn't get over it. Far from love, but... The liberals were the angriest of all. They tried to discredit him. He started the Vietnamese War. And I thought it was the unraveling of America. That's what it felt like to me. And it felt like I always believed they executed him in public to fracture the spirit of the people that survived so they wouldn't try to do anything good. And I took a difficult position, and then I try to make it funny, which is your department. I try to make it funny. And I read the report on the stage at the suggestion of Charles Lawton, who said to me, you don't want to look biased, so pretend to read the report. So I said, I know it by heart. He said, well, I know Shaw by heart, but I pretend to read it. So, you know, there's an emotional engine driving you and a political engine. Most of the people think it's a political engine, or they say he was self-destructive. And of course, in this town, you know, you should be able to get somebody to do that for you. My son, you know, went to Uni High, and the teacher looked at the seating chart, and she said to him, "Is your father that guy who keeps saying the government killed the president?" He said, "Yeah, that's him." And she said, "When you see a father dinner tonight, tell him that I don't believe a word of it. What do you think of that?" And he said to her, "That's why they got away with it." By the way, when people position it to me now, which are rarely, they said they killed the president. I said, "And got away with it." I want them to remember that and what it means. And then that took me to... That took me to New Orleans, and I had a great fellowship down there in a human sense, the people on the case. And we developed a black humor, which you'd be interested in, which was a defense against the fact that we were in a hopeless situation. Jim Garrison had a very, very black humor. The Smothers Brothers told him that every liberal in Hollywood was with him, and he said, "What phone booth do you all meet in?" You know, he was like that, and he was like Sandy Meisner, the acting coach. Mm-hmm. He'd say, "Now that we know it's hopeless, let's junk it and get on with it." And anyway, not to dwell on that, but he was a wonderful man, the bravest American I ever knew, and Stevenson was probably the most noble.
You did the noblest and the bravest. Who's the hippest?
Kennedy was very hip. He said that sex was nature's joke on men and love is nature's joke on women. And he knew what was going on, but of course he fought what we all fight, which is to be our father's sons. I don't know if you fight it. I tried to live up to what I thought it was. And, you know, it's still around, Harry. You know, Stan Kenton was like my spiritual father.
Mm.
He shaped everything about me. And to this day, the guys that were on the band are like my brothers. Mm. The ones who damn the old man and the guy who defends the old man. But it was a family, and I'm a Freudian at this late date, and because I think it might be that I want to keep the personal stuff away, I made it into a joke. made it into a joke. That the Jews change the way people think, starting with Moses, who gives them the law, and they won't obey the law because they want what they stole. And then Jesus, who says, forgive the people that stole. And people say, I can't. I've become too attached to what I stole. And then Marx, who says, can you share it with other people? They say, absolutely not. And then Freud comes along, another Jew, and he says, can you understand people who stole it and won't share it? And they say, no. And then Einstein comes along with the bomb, and he says, I know how to blow all of this up, and this catches on. A long-winded joke.
It's a good joke,
though. I mean, as a technician, sometimes I wonder, I say to myself, can I get this down? Because Bob Hope used to talk to me about cutting the fat out.
You know, I saw Rodney Dangerfield working on jokes before he went on the air at Saturday Night Live when he was hosting. And that's the first time I saw a joke technician at work doing exactly what you're describing, cutting the fat. He was just obsessed with getting any extra word out of the joke. I've seen you recently. I saw you a few years back at the Westwood Playhouse, and I was still amazed that Not at your intelligence and your interest in knowledge of current affairs, but at your technical prowess as a joke writer. You constantly retain the ability to turn all of this into technically expert jokes. They don't wander, and they're deft, and they have that cogency.
I think a lot about the audit. You know, if you come along and you say to me. Or you hear a joke and you think it's facile, but not really digging, I worry about it.
Oh, I don't think it's facile. I just marvel at the fact that you have the ability to take a complex thought and the desire and the talent to hone it in that way. And how much, when you're doing an act, how much work do you do on trimming the fat of these?
It won't come. You know, it would make me more secure if I could prepare. It won't come until I get up there, and you know how risky that is. You know, if you're off or you're physically ill, and the rigidity that I have. You know, I'm still running into kids who say to me, you really helped me. I went backstage at Mr. Kelly's, and I said to you, people say I'm not really zeroing in on the audience. And I immediately jump in and say, they're wrong. I probably destroyed their lives. You know, it's funny, and that's what appeals to me about it. But, you know, putting what I was saying earlier about pushing away people that are getting too close personally by a joke, sometimes you don't need it. You know that. You're married. Sometimes women need an answer. My wife's mother was out here from Atlanta, and she ran out of Zoloft. And I went to the doctor and got some, and I came down and I gave it to her, like the miracle worker. She kissed me on the cheek, and that would have been enough. But immediately I went into a long thing about, you know, put it in drive and step on the gas, because when he finds out I stole it, I'm already constructing something that will, I don't know. That's what the analysts say. You're pushing people away. I'm sure, thought that the quickest way was the joke.
Mm-hmm. I thought there, certainly when I was a kid, that there was something liberating about saying something you really thought in a form that could get a laugh, you know?
Well, when we started, I thought so too. Maybe there's Maybe there's too much understanding in heavy italics. There's an army of bad psychologists in Los Angeles.
You helped invent something else that you probably don't deserve the blame for at this point, but talk radio. I remember a show you did in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's very generous.
And it was a remarkable show. It was a remarkable lineup of people, but you were sort of the capstone of it. You were on every day doing a mixture of comedy and what was on your mind and taking calls from listeners back basically in the dawn of all this. When you hear the guys who are doing talk radio now, what do you think they're not getting about?
Well, you know, they're lazy. If we were in the hall and not on the air and I postulated something to you and you thought about it, and you differed with me about the conclusion, that'd be it. But they're so transparent in thinking that this side is going to win. And not necessarily. They never win. If you remember the Watergate hearings, I'm sure you've got it all on tape.
Yes, I do. You know me well.
When John Mitchell was arguing with Sam Ervin, Ervin said to him, "Don't be think because of a momentary financial advantage that God can be mocked."
You did daily radio for how long?
Well, I did it in here in 67 for Metro Media, KLAC. Then I did it for WNBC in New York briefly, and then in 79 I went to Washington for NBC, WRC.
Mm. Oh, so I didn't know you did it that.
They hired me because they were, 33rd in the market. And by the way, two things happened on that show. Harry, I'm glad you asked me. One kid called me up, and he said to me, Bush the first had come up with the neutron bomb, remember?
Mm-hmm. Killed people but saved buildings.
That's right. Yeah. And the kid said, the Republicans have come up with the perfect weapon. It'll wipe out your immediate family but leave your mortgage intact. Who's going to top that? And the other thing is, the CIA people called me in the afternoon and were amused. They said, we listen, and it's engaging, and it's funny. And at a secondary level, your illusion that you can win is amusing around here.
Wow.
And I wasn't hurt by it. They were, and all the feminists.
You were enough of a radio person that every listener counts, right? What was your feeling earlier this year when you heard the Democrats and the liberals talking about forming their own answer to right-wing talk radio?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. Boy, you really zeroed in. I tried to find out who's doing it. So I called Craig Kitchen, whom you must know, at Premier.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me the name of the guy that did the New York Times interview. You remember? The New York Times covered it?
Yes.
There'd be an all. And he said, he's in Atlanta. Well, I couldn't find him. But then I found out there's a money man that keeps him going, who is a philanthropist in Oak Park, Illinois. An elderly couple. And then he said, Kitchen said something really profound to me. He said, if they can't get Al Franken, they might not do it. And he said to me, Kitchen said, I had tremendous success by focusing on a person rather than their philosophy. And he said, I document this with Dr. Laura and Rush. And Rush brings me to the fact that, Rush's brother manages Drudge.
Really?
As well.
Wow.
And I had, if you ever wonder, Harry, where I am when you don't see me, I had dinner at the airport Sheraton with Drudge and Roy Masters.
Oh, my God.
And Drudge took the hat off and put it on the side of the booth. He said, because I'm me now.
I'm Matt. I'm not Drudge.
You saw, parenthetically, Stanley Tucci as Winchell on HBO?
No, I didn't.
They did an autobiographical movie, and the director, good thing we're not on television, the director had him play Winchell like he was a maniac. Did you know Winchell? Are
no.
you old enough?
No, I'm not old enough.
Oh, I knew him.
Really?
He was very good at what he did, because look who arrived in his wake.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one of Herb Sargent's remarks when Rupert Murdoch bought the New York Post. He said, that makes Earl Wilson the most serious writer on the paper. I'm digressing. Getting back to your original thing, when I was on radio, it was the same thing. You know, I was having trouble digging up work, and I thought it would create activity. And I had the weekly show on television mm-hmm. and the radio show 15 hours a week. And I told myself that there are a lot of young people out there that want to hear that it's okay not to go to Canada instead of Vietnam. So at that time, mm-hmm. I don't think it would be as easy now with the culture driving them crazy. With kids in Beverly Hills going to movies in Westwood dressed as gangbangers. All of that insanity. You remember Dorothy Parker's great quote when she watches a movie she abhors. And the guy next to her says, those whores, why don't they write the best they're capable of? And she said, that may be it.
Yes.
Maybe if they could do better, they would. Although I find myself unconvinced by this argument.
I'm going to put this in the same file with the hoary cliche, nobody ever sets out to make a bad movie, which I've been in a movie that people set out to make badly. It was called The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. And yes, they did set out to make
Jonathan it. Was in that, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And Stocker Chan, who had a great cast. That didn't stop it from being a really horrible movie.
You know, there's a quote from somebody I bet we all enjoyed, Ed Gardner and Duffy Stavern.
Yeah.
Orson Welles says to him, everybody comes to that set and they report hoping to make the best movie they can. And Archie pauses and he scratches his head, because I was there when they did the shows. That's what I used to do. And he says, then there must be a guy with a pass key to the studio who goes in and makes the pictures I see.
Yeah, exactly.
The working man has spoken.
What was your very first gig in show business?
I worked at the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. I bet you know.
Sure.
With a bunch of my friends, Shorty Rogers and Milt Bernhardt, the Kenton alumni, Shelley Mann. And I went on Halloween. He paid me $10. Howard Rumsey said I was terrible, and I gave him the money back. Angry, of course.
Yeah.
Angry.
Opening for the band as a comedian.
Yeah, and of course I didn't know what I was doing anyway, but I also worked with a group called Theater X for experimental at the Las Palmas Theater in 1951, and Alvin Sargent was one of the actors.
Wow.
And I did the best I could, but I was writing mostly then. And then I had to conquer this fear to get up on the stage, because I realized as long as you bring these premises to comedians that don't understand it, they're going to demoralize you. They'll never buy it. And they'll demoralize it under the guise that the average man won't understand it. They understand the average man. Jerry Lewis used to say it to me all the time. You know, I could be Thomas Wolfe, he said, but I know it doesn't pay, he said to me.
You were afraid to get on stage.
I was very, very timid. In fact, Truman Capote once said to me, some people in San Francisco were talking about my courage of what I say. And Capote said, if he was really courageous, he wouldn't have made a joke out of the statement.
Going back to that split in comedy that you sort of represented the vanguard of, because you get credit for sort of blazing the trail for what was called, it's weird to remember this now.
Sick humor?
Sick humor. Time magazine called it sick comics.
Somebody used that Monday as a screwball.
Really?
Yeah, I quoted Hope on the Nobel Peace Prize for Kissinger.
Yeah.
He's the first German I ever met who stopped the war. So a guy with a thick German accent accused me of making a sick joke.
Sick.
Go ahead.
Now, where did that usage come from? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I do. When Jonathan would tell something, you know, I worked with him in 54, Jonathan.
Mm, no.
At the Blue Angel.
Wow.
We were together. And I remember it because I never left when he was on. Because anything could happen. And real stuff happened. I mean, people didn't throw him hats and say, you're an African explorer, Jonathan. You're the captain of the African Queen. It wasn't like that.
Mm.
Jonathan would make this real graphic joke. And then as a demi-apology, he would say, sick, sick.
Ah.
So that you wouldn't say it.
Uh-huh.
And then people like Joe Hyams, you know Joe.
Yeah.
In an attempt to encapsulate the era, we're looking for a term, like beatnik.
Mm-hmm. And he's fixed on sick.
Lenny?
Yeah.
You know, anything about people being handicapped.
But it encompassed Shelley Berman, who was...
Yeah.
You know...
Their history is confused.
Yeah.
Jerry Nachman's new book, which, did you see, Seriously Funny?
No.
He's written about the whole period in San Francisco. You'll enjoy it.
Mm.
And 672 pages, exhaustively researched. Joan Rivers is in there.
Yeah.
Cosby is in there.
Well, you know, there's a certain extent to which you're trapped by the time in which you come up, and you're lumped with the people that you came up with.
Nichols and May.
Yeah, regardless of whether you have anything in common with them or not. But you really represented something that opened the door for people to do comedy in a different way. And what I was trying to get to was, did you feel antagonistic towards the suit wearers, the my wife is so fat comics? Did you ever join the Friars Club? Did you maintain a stance of...
I was never asked.
Is that true?
Yeah. By the way, we're back to an example of Garrison's humor. He was interviewed by Reed Collins on CBS Radio. And he said, do you know a comedian named Mort Saul? He claims he knows you. And Garrison said, oh, yes, I know him. And he said, would you say he's bitter? He said, yes, I would. And I know the roots of it. He said he was in Berkeley 7 years. and all his classmates were recruited by the CIA, and he was never invited. And he grew more and more resentful.
You were never invited to join the Friars Club,
no,
though.
No, I have to tell you, Harry, nobody ever offered me a swimming pool if I would write a musical. I have never, as much as I'd like to remain heroic here to the audience, I never, either somebody hires me who knows what I do, or they keep away. I've never been offered a big compromise. I don't know if that isn't all fiction.
Mm.
Rod Serling-esque.
Mm-hmm. But did you see yourself as the antithesis of the suit wearers? Did you ever?
Not in the beginning.
Yeah.
I was just glad to be able to pay the rent, which was $18 a month in Berkeley.
Who makes you laugh? Or who made you laugh when you were coming up?
Herb Schreiner.
Mm.
Henry Morgan.
Wow, yeah.
Fred Allen.
Sure.
Dinner at the Waldorf. Walk in with Fred Allen. It says, the National Conference of Christians and Jews. He says, notice the billing. But cynical, Harry, which broke my heart at the time. I was only in my early 30s. He kept saying to me, you'll never make it. People are too dumb. And it'll never work. And Pat Weaver said to him, you're wrong, Fred. He will succeed, and he will have everything he wants. And about the time I was about to smile, he said, whether he wants it or not is a different issue.
Wow.
What a good guy. Did you know him?
I met him a couple times.
I don't think you'd have been disappointed.
But I was a huge fan of his.
And he loved talent.
Mm.
And he would go to the mat for talent.
I just read his book. I just read his
autobiography. Oh, yeah?
It's a wonderful book. Yeah, have you read it?
No, what's the name of it?
The Best Seat in the House. He wrote it in 1993, and it's just this wonderfully chatty account of his life, and it's really fascinating.
A remarkable guy.
Yeah, yeah. Widely ignored. And when he died, I thought, this nobody even gets who this guy was.
He was their nemesis.
Yeah, he really was. And he came from within. That's the thing.
By the way, very good. Very good. That's exactly what was going on with Kennedy. There was a hatred that you and I together could not muster because he was a traitor to his class.
You know, I had the same theory about Clinton, why the Clinton haters went after him.
Tell me.
Because he was a traitor to his race, because he was a feminized white Southerner, and a traitor to his gender. It's longer of theory than I can kind of capsulize here, but I wrote a little book about it.
Well, you think that was the genesis of the resentment?
Yeah, because you think, Bill Clinton didn't stand for enough to generate this kind of hatred. It
That's
had
right.
to be something symbolic.
So they were mad at him from the last movie.
Yeah, right.
That's really good. That's really interesting.
The CIA.
Yes.
Here we live in a time when intelligence analysts are leaking to the media. We told them the information. It's what they did with it that the battle between the finger pointing that's brewing between the politicians and the intelligence people. How do you see this?
Well, there was a big argument in Garrison's office. The big wit there was Andy Shambra, who was the chief assistant. Garrison would say, this was a dumb move. And Shambra would say, they know exactly what they're doing. And I would say, why are they so arrogant to try and do this? Typical Mort. And my wife would say, maybe they became arrogant as they continued to succeed. Which, of course, is true.
Mm-hmm.
And then Garrison finally went to the position of they've got all the money in the world, ours, and all the time in the world to think up the schemes. But I came to believe in later years that very little of this is spontaneous. The idealistic part of me always thinks they will go too far, but there's really no... there's no evidence to back up this devoutly held belief. Have I answered your question?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I if you had to say which side you believe between the politicians, say, well, we haven't put the thumb on the scale, the intelligence scale, and the intelligence analysts who are going, they've cooked our stuff. Do you come down instinctively siding with one side or another in that argument?
If it was a guy like Jack Brooks, I would believe him. I wouldn't believe too many of the people that are around now. I mean...
Jack Brooks, the ex-congressman.
Yeah, from Texas.
From Texas.
But I don't know that...
That's a different generation of Texas politician, isn't it?
Quite so.
Yeah.
Henry Gonzalez.
Yeah.
I don't know that... They've got this thing so well orchestrated. A CIA officer said this to me. I said, Fujimori in Peru wants to buy planes from Lockheed. We don't want to let him do that because of human rights, Jim Baker says. His human rights are in. So he says, well, I'll go to the Russians. And the CIA officer said to me, he'll still be buying from us. I've heard some wild stuff, Harry.
That's pretty global. Well, yeah, you've hung out with... Your friends include Alexander Haig.
I heard you one day about that.
Yes?
I heard you one Sunday talking about that. Yeah, and I can tell you, you know, you deserve real honesty. He knows I'm in on the gag. And he likes the fact that I'm perceptive. The attraction of the right-wing people is that they think I'm pure. I don't know how they came across, but somehow they believe that. They think I'm pure, and so they're drawn to me. Who were you going to say? Who else?
No, that was the one that always caught my attention. But this goes back to something you were saying earlier about Joe Kennedy's reaction to you. And this is one reason... why, despite my affection for the idea of sometimes knowing these guys, I've kind of stayed away from it. The idea that they turn on you in surprise when, well, you're making fun of me. Well, that's the gig. That's what I do. Why would I stop? How do you avoid the danger of being co-opted by these friends, by having friends who are actually the objects of your humor?
Well... it depends how bright they are. Haig is very bright, so even though he made his choices, the following went on with us at dinner one night. He said to me, I just come back from this trip to Russia. He said, Moscow is really something. It's booming. He said, I went to the Intercontinental Hotel, and... these 600 Mercedes would come up, these SELs. And the boomer would get out with an 18-year-old blonde on his arm and a Rolex. And he'd go in and order an apple martini, not vodka. And, why, my God, I might as well have been in Beverly Hills. And I said, except there weren't any communists. So he laughs. In other words, he allows me to be me. Of course, we can't say that that joke is cramping any of his style,
yeah.
Certainly. Kissinger is openly suspicious. He doesn't want to be my friend. But
what do you get out of people in show business are normally friends with people in show business. It's rare that people in show business are friends with people at that level of government. You know, you find sometimes they'll pal around with the more glamorous front guys in government, but you like hanging out with the guys who really know what's going on. Is that the thrill for you, is that you get to talk to people who really know what the
story
is?
Well, some of them came with work, you know, writing.
Yeah.
Some of them came with writing. Some people just approached me about Biden. He's going to make a run at it. But
the hair plugs have finally grown
the
in?
The hair plugs, yeah. And is going home on the train every day to Dover. Mm-hmm. I think your point is very well taken about what the price would be to be accepted there. For instance, they're all friends with Mark Russell.
Yes, exactly.
And I suppose the Democrats, I understand Wolfowitz threw a punch at the correspondence dinner at Franken.
Really? Yes, I heard that too, and I didn't know who to root for.
And Reagan never demanded. He was puzzled by it all. He said to me once, "You know Paul Newman, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Why is he a liberal?" And he said to me, "You know Norman Lear?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "He's a liberal." I said, "Yeah, he is." He said, "Well, can't you talk any sense to those guys?" I said, "Sometimes it's guilt." "Why?" I said, "The Jewish Gulf." I said, "Feeling they don't deserve what they have." Then I covered it with a joke. I said, "Well, I agree with them. They don't deserve it." But he couldn't understand it. Mm. Well, you don't take what you find in America and exult in it. So I haven't seen an awful lot of them lately. Sometimes they just see in the media. Some of the CIA guys were interesting. They liked the idea that they understood heavy quotes, intellectual humor, and that separated them from the mass. But I agree with you. Clinton never did anything dangerous enough for them to vow the rest of their lives to pursue him and bring him to ground. Haig never asked me to question anything. I was in his house once. I was doing an impression of Hope. And I said, "Hey, those guys in Amway are something else, aren't they?" And he put his finger to his lips and he said, "Mort, please, they paid for the chandelier." I guess he feels there are a lot of people that he couldn't say that to. I don't know what would happen. On the other hand, you know, Roger Ailes was my manager.
I didn't know that.
He was my manager for 5 years.
Wow.
But I don't see myself getting hired at the Fox Network.
Well, they're fair and balanced. They have room for you. You quoted Garrison, I think, earlier, describing you as bitter. Is that the way you describe yourself now?
No, I certainly would not.
You also describe yourself as optimistic. Are you still optimistic?
I'm still optimistic. And I don't know if it's justified, but I'm certainly optimistic. I think there's a lot of bright young people. There's those people in the middle I don't know about. You know, all those Jewish guys, that lawyers who want to run studios, are all named Eric. I worry about them, you know. And things don't seem to be getting any better between men and women. Or do you think they are?
I'm celebrating my 10th anniversary, but as a general principle.
That's remarkable.
Thank you. We owe it all to caffeine. it's the only drug we have in common. I don't talk and think a lot about this issue. You really do focus on
all
it much
time.
More.
Do you get lonesome?
Not as much as I used to.
Do you get depressed?
Not as much as I used to.
And what form does it take? Because you're always productive.
It takes the form of just like going to bed and sleeping for a month. I mean, that was my last depression. Was that?
Elaine May thought that was a funny premise. I wonder if you and I are forgiving. I think neither one of us is very forgiving of no talent.
I'm regarded as an Old Testament kind of a guy.
Really?
Yeah. 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 You don't want to cross me.
You know, when you ask people who were on a show and you're alumni, and they answer about anybody, this isn't necessarily direct to you, but when they say, "Oh, you know," when they do and they react like that, that can mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You may have held out for not going along with compromises that were never elicited. And I think that rage comes out of deep sadness. I mean, real disappointment. It raised exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation must have come out of the movies. But I think expectation is a legitimate form of employment. I like it. I'm all for it, you know. And The women want to fight, but they don't want to win. Something in them is very wise, which they manage to control sometimes. But I'm not easy. I'm certainly not easy, and I do a lot of judging. But, you know, we've come to a time where real satire is interpreted as being unkind.
Mm.
And should you spend your time as an artist, which is eventually really limited and precious, to be indulging people who don't have anything to offer? You remember, Harry, when Churchill said, courage is the greatest virtue because it makes all the others possible. Maybe with both of us living in L.A., maybe envy is the worst sin because it brings...
It is, indeed.
And then there's all the marginal resentment. There's all the people managed by Brad Gray who aren't getting as much attention as the guy he sold the home box office. But they've misled a lot of people. They still think they're going to take the mic off the stand and say, how are you guys tonight? It's painful. You know what I used to do, Harry? I used to go... We lived in Southgate.
Wow.
Kind of hopeless. And I used to wander up there, and I'd get extra tickets to radio shows. And when they dropped the pages, I'd take them home. And then I had an art student next door to me who made rim velocity mics with the triangles and would make me the logo. And then I'd read the scripts when I was 10 years old. And I saw at CBS, speaking of CBS, I saw Burns and Allen there with Artie Shaw's band. Yes, sir.
Speed to the inevitable conclusion by saying you are still active, you still work, you still can be seen doing what you do.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Janine sent you a flyer.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was reminded to say this.
And I'm also gonna work in Chicago. And
do you know your dates? You know, we might as well. We're on the air in Chicago. We might as well say all this stuff.
And of course, on Thursday, I'll be at Uncle Funny's Giggle Bung for 1 hour. You know, it's interesting. All the club owners wanted to discover new talent. I think that was the premise of their search.
They wanted to be Bud Friedman when they grew up.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You guys have been great.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, when anybody was established and wanted to be paid, they thought that was onerous. You can't really find too many people that really endorse capitalism, can you?
Not in practice, no.
I mean, we're all G8 protesters.
Yeah, we're in accounts. So you will be in L.A. and Chicago, anywhere else that we should...
I'm going to Seattle, and then I'm going back to New Jersey for a club date, an organization. And then I'll do the Letterman show. I'm not sure of the date. And, you know, try to keep it going. What I'd really like to do, I'd like to take a bus, a motorhome, the Freedom Bus, and go to every Borders and every Starbucks and every junior college and talk vox pop to people about... What do you really think is going on? I'm working on that, and I'd really like to. I haven't told anybody except my wife. That's what I want to do, and I'm gonna ask Norman Lear if we can put this together, and not do what Hardball does, where they go to a college and they watch this Ventura talk. Let them talk. And we'll see if you and I think there's anybody out there in the dark, if we're right. The heartland.
Yeah.
The heartland. That's where all the folks are.
Yeah.
And, some pretty noble folks. If there weren't, you and I really ought to take a rowboat and go to Denmark. I mean, come on. Garrison used to have a saying. He'd say to me, when I talk to a witness... If he says, I loved Kennedy, I leave. Bring my car around to the front. He says, if he says, I voted for him, I step in the accelerator. He said, if he's wearing a PT-109 thigh clip, I'm ready to take a kayak and go to Europe. Which, of course, was his way of expressing his broken heart. Who did he laugh at? Jonathan Winters, who is the ultimate anti-authoritarian. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, yeah.
But he's the real thing.
But the authority figure was inside him. That was the big fight for him, wasn't it?
Very good. I was with him recently up there.
Yeah.
And he should go out with me. People would love to hear him.
Oh, my God, yeah. Who are you voting for next year?
Well, either Dennis Kucinich or Howard Dean. By the way, notice they called Dean reminiscent of McCarthy. Do you read that, too?
Gene McCarthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gene McCarthy's in a retirement home.
I saw, yeah.
But he called me. And he said that it's never been this depressing. It's like unmoving, you know, maple syrup. It's a torpor. And what's the simple joke? Bush is trying to land on the deck of a submarine below New York Harbor. I hope we can resuscitate the Democratic Party. That's how desperate I am.
That is desperate indeed, sir. Thank you, Mort.
Oh, Harry, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're in the Los Angeles or Southern California area in mid-August, Mort Saul will be at McCabe's, and he'll be around the country, as he indicated on the broadcast. My thanks to Bjorn Schaller at Warren Dewey Studios for recording and engineering today's interview. That will put the cap on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, and across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio and on your computer via the Internet around the world whenever you want it at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like me being back here live next week if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.